Podium. And then we'll have a presentation from the Coalition for the Homeless and a presentation from Minnesota Housing Partnership, as much as we can do of this today, and I hope we can get through the agenda. I just wanted to give a chance, though, for those folks who went on a tour of homeless shelters last night. We wanted to just report back to the committee on any of your impressions.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. It was a great opportunity to kind of get out and see what's happening in the city or in our metro area in terms of homelessness. And I think the first one we went to was pretty much of an eye-opener. There were three areas or three institutions that basically house some of our homeless who are looking for a shelter to live in. There was a lottery for basically 22 beds, and there were probably 70 people within the area that we were doing the tour on, and there were a bunch of people that were currently working and calling in, and they had a lottery for these 22 beds. So it kind of made you wonder, where are the rest of these individuals going if their number isn't drawn? So it was very compelling to say, especially when you're standing outside and it's about 20 below at the wind chill, is very telling. And so there are needs out there that I think we are hopefully working on, and I think the governor's put that program in effect to try and meet the homeless population within 2010. But it was a good eye-opener for a lot of us to be able to be there and see some of the situations that these people have gotten into, whether it's because of some bad decisions. It's kind of irrelevant. They're people who need to be looked after. So appreciate the, there were a couple other places that we went to, but I won't dominate this. I appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate you being there.
Yes, it was, as he says, very eye-opening. One of the groups we were at was for youth, and it was a day place for them, and then at 8 o'clock, 8:30, they had to be out. And most of them are couch-hopping, just staying here and there, wherever they can. And two of them told their stories. One of them had been kicked out when he was 13, and another one, circumstances, he had no place to go when he was 11. And now they're 19, 20, and they're still trying to get their lives together. And this place helps them get a job, helps them get organized, helps them find, get a plan for their life. And then the adult situations where we were at, where they were, as he said, the lottery at one place, at churches, or the Dorothy Day Center over here in St. Paul. My goodness, we are freezing when we walk to the bus, and they need a place to sleep for the night, and they get a mat on the floor. Just the bottom line services for the people that are most needy in our community is something we need to attend to.
Thank you. Anybody else, staff, that want to make any comment? Okay, well, thank you all, and I think those of us who went there, a few more that are not here right now, really, it was helpful. We're going to hear more, I think, today. We'll be having presentations on this. Okay, let's start with an overview from the Department of Human Services. Is Mr. Johnson, Mr. Johnson here? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. I know, just to review, one of the things that we did ask the department to do is to help us look at some of the outcomes as well as the actual budget numbers, and take us back in time to look at where we came with those, with the budget for this division. So why don't you go ahead and start, and I want to make sure the committee gets some time to answer questions. So summarize where appropriate and give us details where we need it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, this committee has jurisdiction over a couple of pieces of what we do within the Children and Family Services area of the department. So you can understand the context, I'll just tell you very briefly the other pieces that we have. We have the public assistance programs such as MFIP and food stamps within my part of the department, as well as child care programs, child support enforcement, and the child welfare infrastructure, child protection, foster care, and so forth. So those are the pieces that are within the Children and Family Services area that are within, I believe, Representative Huntley's committee and Representative Slavik's committee in terms of the jurisdiction over the budget. And so those pieces fit together with the pieces I'm going to go into more detail about, which are the pieces which are within the jurisdiction of this committee. Madam Chair, the budget pages start on page 91 of the book that I have. You may have a tab that gets you to the DHS part of your book. I'm not sure. The page that I'm looking at is called Refugee Services Grants.
Members, you have a packet on your desk that you can page 91 in that packet. Okay.
Madam Chair, this page, this budget activity addresses refugee services. These are federally funded services to refugees in Minnesota. Refugees, as most of you probably know, are people who come here from other countries due to a fear of persecution such that they can't return to their own country. They're resettled in this country. Minnesota has consistently been, over the last several years, the second or third highest in the nation in terms of the number of refugees resettling in our state. Starting back almost 30 years ago with the Southeast Asian population, and more recently a lot of folks from East Africa who are resettling here. These are federally funded services, refugee cash assistance, which is available to refugees who are not eligible for the MCIP program, for our cash assistance program for families, so it's mostly single individuals, which is sort of 960 people in a given year. Refugee medical assistance, which likewise is for people who are not eligible for the medical assistance or Medicaid program, can receive medical assistance through the refugee dollars. And social services, which fund a variety of services in the community, including employment, housing, other kinds of services to help support refugee families and individuals as they make the transition from their country to this new culture here in Minnesota. The budget activity for this is on page 92 of your book. About $11 million in 2006, going up to $18 million in 2007. This, as I mentioned earlier, are all federal dollars.
Mr. Johnson, just a question. In terms of the governor's recommendation on this, can you point that out as we go along as well?
Madam Chair, I will. There are no governor's recommendations okay. in this all budget right. activity.
No changes.
No change. Madam Chair, the next budget activity is on page 93. This addresses, it's called Other Children and Economic Assistance Grants. It covers a wide swath of parts of our business, dealing largely with food, with housing, with community-based services. A lot of the services that we deliver to the Department of Human Services are delivered by the counties on our behalf, or state-supervised county-administered system. A lot of the services that you'll find here, as well as the refugee services, are delivered through community agencies who we contract with, not as much directly by the counties, and so that's a little bit different, the purview that this committee has versus some of the other services that we provide for the department. As I mentioned, these services focus a lot on food and housing. The food stamp program is included on this page. We call it Food Support in Minnesota, which serves about 250,000 individuals in a given month. This is the federally funded food stamp program that provides a basic grant that folks can use for food every month. As well as that in the food category, we also have services for commodities, where we provide commodities to food shelves and other places that serve congregate meals, as well as funding for the food shelves themselves so they can distribute through their networks the food that goes out to all the individual food shelves around Minnesota. This activity also includes housing services. We have funding for emergency services for shelters, as well as money for transitional housing, which are services that help people move off of the streets and for up to 24 months in a transitional setting, which then allows them to transition into permanent housing. In addition, this activity includes the existing dollars for the Ending Long-Term Homeless Initiative. I'll turn and talk more about that in a second when I talk about the governor's change proposal in this area. This activity also includes funding for the community action agencies. Community action agencies are agencies that were created by the federal government under the guise of the federal government almost 40 years ago. There are 38 of them spread around Minnesota, serving the entirety of the state. They are essentially a community-based organization that provides a variety of different services. Most of them provide the low-income energy assistance as well as weatherization. Some, not all, provide Head Start services. And in addition, they provide whatever services that community needs. They really fit within the need of their own community. The funding for the community action agencies is both federal pass-through dollars as well as state general fund dollars. In addition, this activity includes some of our program integrity, including fraud prevention grants, which are provided to counties. Counties use those dollars to work on preventing fraud within our public assistance programs. This is an activity that has proven very effective over the years. We return about $5 for each dollar we spend in this area in terms of identifying and recovering dollars that have been obtained fraudulently. Madam Chair, the budget activity is on page 95. As I mentioned, a lot of this is federal dollars, and a lot of it is passed through to community agencies, usually via grant contracts.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd move on then to page 96. This is a change page, governor's proposal in the area of ending long-term homelessness. As most of you are aware, several years ago, the governor created a business plan for ending long-term homeless. This plan was created with the input of many folks who work in the homeless area, as well as folks around Minnesota, and has been implemented over the last several years by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Corrections as the three lead agencies working on it. The focus of the plan is really to develop supportive housing units for long-term homeless folks. We know that many of the folks who are long-term homeless on the streets for months or years at a time are suffering, often suffering from multiple disabilities, and particularly mental health and chemical health issues. As a result, giving them housed often isn't enough, because without additional services, they'll lose the housing and end up back on the street. And likewise, trying to deliver services to them when they're unstably housed isn't very effective in terms of trying to address the issues that the individual is suffering. Supportive housing really brings the two together. It brings together the bricks and mortar part of creating units, the rental assistance and operating costs of keeping those units funded so somebody can live there, and then also the services that the individuals need in order to stabilize their lives, address the issues, the treatment issues that they need for themselves. The plan is set to create 4,000 supportive housing units by the 2010. We're about a little past a quarter of the way into that in terms of developing units. The Department of Human Services' role in this is really on the service side, and that is both to help work with the individual supportive housing units or services to identify how to bring the services that are funded through all the existing funding streams that are within our department to bear on these populations. That is to take advantage of that existing infrastructure of services that are available to people with disabilities and mental health and so forth. But also to administer funds that help provide some additional services that are needed in order for the supportive housing model to work. In 2005, the legislature appropriated $10 million for the biennium for supportive services for the Ending Long-Term Homeless Initiative. We administer those, have granted those dollars out across Minnesota, and are currently in place supporting supportive housing services across Minnesota. This budget proposal proposes additional funding in three areas. First, $1.65 million for supportive services. That is to add to the money that was appropriated the last budget cycle for supportive services for folks in supportive housing units. A portion of these dollars, $175,000 a year, would be used for emergency services. That is to help fund shelters. Shelters are sort of the first line in the ending long-term homeless effort. Wherein folks who are homeless enter into the shelter. The shelters have a job to try to help us get those folks stabilized and into other places where we can find a permanent placement for them. This money would help them with that. The other $1.475 million in that area would go with the additional $5 million we have in the base now for additional supportive services. In addition, this proposal includes $250,000 a year for transitional housing program. That's to expand the services we currently provide in that program. This is also a preventative in terms of the ending long-term homeless. About a third of the families we estimate who are in transitional housing are long-term homeless, so we're capturing part of that population and also reinforcing that those services sort of surround the core effort of creating the supportive housing units for long-term homeless. Finally, we're requesting $100,000 a year for program infrastructure and administration. Department of Human Services and MHFA and Corrections are administering this program now. We're doing it mostly on dollars that we've created within our own budgets. This would request money for two systems which would help in terms of our implementation of the initiative. first $38,000 to expand the homeless management information system. This is a system that tracks and allows us to identify individual homeless and unduplicate account of homeless and where they are and what kind of services they're receiving. This is a federally required system, but the feds don't provide us any money for it. We're currently doing it within internal resources. This would help stabilize that system and make it a better tracking tool for the initiative and for all of our homeless work within Minnesota. In addition, we're requesting $62,000 to expand the use of a web-based tool that allows folks who are working with homeless to identify where there are supportive housing and other kinds of placements or units available in order to place people. That tool is currently available in the metro area. We would like to expand it so we could also be using it outside the metro area to support programs there. Madam Chair, the budget is found at the bottom of the page, a little under $2 million a year in the governor's request.
Mr. Moe, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johnson, I thank you for presenting this information to us. I have two questions for you. One is, since this, and I guess I question the term ending long-term homelessness, frankly, but since this program has begun, I mean, at least where I live, homelessness has been on the rise, not on the decline. Maybe you could talk about how the homelessness numbers in the state of Minnesota, you know, are we in fact getting ahead of that at all? And if in fact we were to want to end long-term homelessness, and with all due respect, this is really a drop in the bucket for, in my estimation, for the magnitude of the problem we have to deal with, and maybe you could comment on that too.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Moe. The best count of homelessness is the one that's done by the Wilder Research that they do every third year in October. They do a one-night count. That was done this past October. We don't yet have the count for it, so we're not sure where we stand exactly in terms of where we were 3 years ago when the count was last done in terms of the number of homelessness or homeless. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you that most of the other tracking we do in terms of tracking folks moving through shelters and so forth suggests that there are still a lot of homeless in Minnesota and that the numbers may be higher and have been going up over the last couple of years. It's hard to judge that without that sort of systematic way that Wilder actually does the count. In terms of this initiative, this is really targeted at a particular population, and that's the population that we term the long-term homeless. Those are folks who have been on the streets for a year continuously or four times in the last 3 years. As I mentioned, it tends to be people who are more affected by mental health disorders, chemical health, often dually, or other kinds of disabilities. And so the target here isn't as ambitious as saying we're going to end homeless, which would be a completely difficult, different thing to do and much more difficult because of the nature of how people become homeless and how long they stay there and so forth. I do think it is very much a good faith effort to do everything we can for this population that we can identify to try to get them into situations that we know are going to provide them with better housing, more stable housing, and who are a much a core population that have much different needs than perhaps the homeless more extended do. And that is our goal, to create the 4,000 units. We believe we're able to do that and able to bring the services that are needed to those 4,000 units, that we will make the effort of ending long-term homelessness in Minnesota. And we won't know until we get there exactly how it's going to work, because we don't know all the sort of how people come into long-term homelessness and how they leave. We're trying to work with the numbers we have and set up the business plan and move forward off of that.
Chair.
President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Then I'd like to speak specifically to my own neck of the woods, to be parochial here. My Bemidji, in particular, I think most of the HRDC, Headwaters Regional Development Commission, did a study of housing and homelessness. Long-term homelessness is on the rise, yet we are, as a region, in every way possible, trying to take advantage of the grants that are available from your agency. What would you then recommend to us? I mean, we're missing something or not doing everything that we can based on the resources that are available to us.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, I'm not sure that I have a recommendation of exactly what I tell you to do. I don't I'm not an expert on all the pieces here. When Commissioner Marks is here, he may be able to better address your question. I guess what I would say is, first of all, there are a lot of communities like yours that are trying to pull together all the pieces and do everything they can. And one of the challenges of this is there's a lot of pieces to pull together. It isn't sort of an all-in-one place where you just sort of tap in and suddenly you have the solution and you can put it out there. It requires the getting your hands on bricks and mortar money frequently. It involves getting money on operational kind of rent subsidy money, which we know is largely historically been federally funded and is in short supply these days, as well as the services, which is both a matter of how much we're putting out through these particular targeted grants, but also the ability to tap into those existing services that are delivered through the counties or the health plans or the others within the system that we fund through other parts of my department. And so it is a huge challenge, and it does require bringing a lot of folks together, and at the state level as well, and that's why the three departments are engaged. In that respect, it is a very difficult challenge, and so I would defer in part the question to Commissioner Marks, but I would also say that the challenge that you're talking about is a challenge that a lot of communities are facing in trying to figure out how to address this problem.
Thank you.
Let me just say we will be having Commissioner Marks back for the presentation of the governor's budget being scheduled right now. I think I have Representative McNamara, Sigerson, and Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Johnson, you caught my attention when you said the Wilder counted in October the number of homeless, and they do it every 3 years. And here we are in session in January. I would just ask if either you, your department, or if you could ask the Wilder to get back to the chair on those numbers. Some of that is so frustrating for us as we're trying to deal with this issue. And I don't mean to point the finger at your department, but I would think if they were out and did the count one night in October that we ought to be able to get the numbers within 3 months of what the tally was. And if you could get that, I think just a follow-up to Representative Moll's question, we'd really like to know where we're at and what we should be doing.
Madam Chair, I believe that those numbers will be available in the next couple of months. I'm not sure the exact timing, but I will check into that.
Mr. McNamara, we'll see what we can do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Moe's issue, I think on the outstate, you know, a lot of our towns and cities are dealing with some of these issues. In St. Cloud, we've had an organization called the Place of Hope that has stood up to the plate and actually been very effective in the committee and community in central Minnesota area. But I think one theme that came throughout last night when we went around to the different places was that these were initiatives that were put forth through some of the local churches. And the local churches went to the city and they said, you know what, we've got some issues. We want to deal with the homeless population and bring some of these people in and basically minister to them. And the first place I went to, I believe, was it Simon?
Simpson
House, had been in a place for over 30 years. And they had been doing this. And so it really speaks to the church stepping up to the plate and meeting some of those needs. And then they had, in the last place we went to, which was the Jeremiah Center, there was a lady there who had been in this process for just about the same amount of time. It was 20 years. But she had basically stepped up and then come into a corporate gathering group to bring the community, the churches, and the private sector together, and then brought government in at the end for the transitional housing, which was really making an impact to bring people through this process. So the reason I say that is I think, you know, as our state looks at this as an issue to address, we can't forget that the church community is one of those that really has a heart for this, and I think that's where the bottom line needs to start, is where we are in our communities and we want to minister to our communities, to those that are in our community, and not forget the religious organizations that can really spur this thing on, really have the heart to make it happen.
Thank you. Representative Schumper?
Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, why $2 million? Why not $4 million, or $6 million, or $8 million, or $10
million? Madam Chair, Representative, it's simply a matter of setting priorities within creating the governor's budget, and this was the number that we arrived at for this area.
Madam Chair, I guess I take it as not a very high priority then. Is that the way to take it, or what?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, this is adding about $1.5 million to a base of about $5 million. So it's a 30% increase in a fund that was created only 2 years ago. So I think that we're at pace in terms of getting the initiative started and trying to continue to put money in as we build and create additional units. So I think in that direction, it's moving us at the pace that we're trying to develop additional units to create, to ensure that we can have services to go with those units.
I think one of the helpful things might be, again, to look at the historical evolution of these fundings, not just for the specifically named function, but in homelessness in general, and maybe you can come back to that and you can help with that. Meantime, Representative Huntley, I think you had a question?
Madam Chair and Commissioner, do we have any Minnesota data that shows what it costs when these people aren't in housing, when they're out on the street, versus what it costs when they're getting housing? I know in other, particularly in New York City, it costs the public almost twice as much when they're on the street as it does when they're in housing.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, thank you for mentioning that. That is a big impetus for the creation of the plan, was the identification, as in the New York study, that there are significant costs in emergency rooms and other kind of care that is not helping to stabilize somebody for the longer term that come with having these folks on the streets instead of being able to house them stably and provide the services in that setting. The best information for Minnesota will come with the outcome from the supportive housing pilot that we've been running for the last several years in Minnesota, and that information will be available, I believe, within the next couple of months. Is that correct? I'm looking at my staff. That's correct. Which will give us a read on, within that pilot, what were the costs within the pilot versus what those costs would have been if those individuals had been on the streets and we had been paying for all the services that we pay for them through the existing programs without that way of bringing the services and housing together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Can you shed a little light on the overall dollars in terms of homelessness as a package? Not as these individual programs. And if not,
Madam
maybe
Chair,
give it back to us.
The overall dollars in general in homeless from coming from the state level are relatively small, with the exception of the supportive services in our department, with the exception of the supportive services dollars that I just talked about, which were first established in 2005 at a $5 million level, and then with the governor's recommended increase. The additional dollars that we have are some small amounts that I mentioned earlier for emergency shelters, which I believe is in the range of about $1.2 million or so, and then the funding for the transitional housing services, which I believe is currently, I'm going to have to check this one. About $1.8 million.
And that historically was?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask staff if they can help me with the history on the funding for that.
And we'll be hearing from the advocate shortly, and I'm sure they can probably go through that if it's not easily available from staff.
Ms. Spears provided me with a summary provided to you, which is homeless program report that we produced this summer, which gives a history of the programs that we provide and the funding for those. And Ms. Spears is looking to see if she can come up with the number that you asked for.
Well, again, if it's not easily available, I'm sure we can probably get it from our advocates today. I see a head shaking over there. But I think it is helpful for the committee just to know where we've been and where we're going. And I guess the other context that would be helpful is the federal funding or lack of it. And if that's something you can comment on now, fine. If not, we can get this maybe again.
I'm sure what might be easiest for us is just put those numbers together for you and show the history in the programs that are funded through our department for homeless intervention.
Okay. Why don't we do that? Move on then. Thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Madam Chair, that completes the overview of the budget and change pages for Department of Human Services.
Okay. Any questions other question from the staff. I wanted to go back to just for a moment some of the food and nutrition issues, and I guess that is one area where there's a lot of public information about more and more people going to food shelves, less and less available. And I'm just wondering, there is no governor's recommendation for increases in any of those funding. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. There's no recommendations for emergency food funding.
Was that discussed, Mr. Johnson, by your department? Did you have any light you can shed on that or your concerns about that problem?
Madam Chair, I can't discuss internal discussions around creation of the governor's budget. I mean, certainly we recognize that that's an important service that we provide. Some of it is passing through federal dollars. Some of them are state dollars that provide some of the basic funding that goes to the food shelves. Clearly, there's a lot of other funding that comes to food shelves through individual donations and United Way and so forth, other kind of community funding base.
I guess what I'd ask you at least then maybe is to provide us again an overview on the status of decreased resources that are at the food shelves. There's a lot of publicity about that, you know, over the holiday season. And where we're at with hungry people in Minnesota, what you can tell us about that. I think that is the department's purview to provide some oversight on that.
Madam Chair, we can provide that.
All right. I think there will be legislation, too, that tries to address that, so this committee will get to hear, so we'll have some more discussion. Okay, I think we'll be moving on then, unless there's any other questions. Mr. Johnson, okay. Thank you. Appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
We'll start then with the presentation from the Coalition for the Homeless, and Michael Bell, do you want to come forward and bring whoever else you have to make the presentation? Welcome to the committee. Mr. Dillon, I want to thank you again for helping orchestrate the shelter tour last night. It was very helpful and lots of impact, so I thank you for that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And as I told the folks who took the tour last night, I'd be bringing props, and we'll be talking about those shortly. My name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. We're a statewide coalition of people, of advocates, service providers, and people who've experienced homelessness, and we're all committed to the mission, which is ending homelessness in Minnesota. Representative Moe, our mission is to end homelessness in Minnesota. Long-term homelessness, episodic homelessness, and short-term homelessness, it's all within our power to end homelessness. And I want to spend some time here this morning talking about some of the successful approaches. First, I want to give a little bit of an overview of what happened last night. Since some of you were not able to be there, I think that highlighting some of the things that we saw on the tour would be helpful. As was noted by Representative Severson, our first stop was at Simpson Housing Services, which is an emergency shelter. And as was pointed out, there were about 70 individuals, probably more than that, 70 single men, who were competing in a lottery. The prize was a 28-day bed, and I use bed as quotation marks, to stay at one of three privately run shelters. There were a little over 20 people who could win, and many of the people who won actually were call-ins. They were calling in from work saying that they couldn't be there for the lottery, but they wanted to be a part of that competition. And so I would guess that probably 60 or more of the individuals that were sitting there that time were not going to be able to stay at one of the shelters. The losers would have to find out what their accommodations were elsewhere. They were taking part in the lottery for multiple shelters in the metro area, so many of them would be finding their home last night on the streets. Then we went to YouthLink, which is a teen drop-in center that is exploring the possibility of and doing some fundraising for emergency shelter in its basement. They can't offer that shelter yet, so many of the youth just drop in and they have to leave by 8 o'clock. We talked with one teen and we asked where he would go, and he basically said, well, I hope that I'll be able to stay with my friend another night. This individual had become homeless because his mother had kicked him out. And his violation had been that he had protected his mother and his siblings from an abusive stepfather. So he was kicked out, and his penalty was going to Youth Link and finding a place to stay there during the day. This is a situation that you often see with homeless teens fleeing abuse, often trying to protect others in their family of abuse. Next, we went to a supportive housing program, and we heard about women with children who got out of the shelter system into a supportive atmosphere. They received housing, supports, and expectations. Individuals that stay in supportive housing must often contribute part of their income for their housing. They also have to come up with a plan that brings them to a greater degree of self-sufficiency, self-reliance. And there are a diversity of types of programs that exist across the state, and they do exist across the state. I want to point out that there are two forms of supportive housing that you'll hear a lot about. The first is permanent supportive housing, and we talked about the governor's plan to end long-term homeless. People with very high needs, mental health problems, chemical addictions, often stay in permanent supportive housing. It's non-time limited, but we try to get people in supportive atmosphere and not using as costly services that you might often find in corrections, detox, emergency rooms, but instead in supportive housing where they can get their needs met. That accounts, those long-term homeless in permanent supportive housing account for 20% of those who are homeless, if we take a look at what are nationally accepted figures. The rest are not long-term homeless, and they need some other response that is not addressed in the plan to end long-term homeless, but we do have to come to the legislature to come up with responses to address that need. Transitional housing is a part of the answer, which is for people who have more short-term crises that they're trying to address. They may have a bad credit history. They may be fleeing abuse. They may be mentally ill but not have long-term serious problems that they can't work through. And transitional housing will allow them to stay up for up to 2 years. Oftentimes, they stay shorter than that. We can stay up for up to two years and then move on into permanent housing that they may be paying for completely by themselves. We ended at Dorothy Day last night where... Okay, so this is the map that you saw that people at Simpson Housing Services would be staying on. And there were 30 of these maps that people were going to be sleeping on at Simpson. When we went to Dorothy Day, and I think that everybody will vouch for me, that maps were about half this size and about a third as thick. And there were probably over 100 people sleeping in that shelter last night. Think of this as the prize that you got for lottery. Those that lose or maybe decide not to stay at Dorothy Day or Simpson Housing Services would be given a couple of sandwiches and a blanket. This is a surplus Department of Defense blanket that many of the shelters receive. And think about last night and what this would do to cover you from the cold. This is what some people are given when they don't win lottery or there isn't enough space at Dorothy Day. We saw just a sliver of the problem last night, a very small sliver. Homelessness is huge. We have 7,000 people who are lucky enough to get into a sheltering program. We turn 1,000 people away because we lack space and resources. There are 2,000 people who are living on the streets, long-term homeless, that we are trying to get desperately into permanent supportive housing. And on top of that, and we talked with one of the teams that was an example of this, 13,000 people who are precariously housed, couch hopping, staying with friends, relatives, and sometimes strangers as a way to stay so that they're not homeless. They may know where they're staying tonight, but they don't know where they're staying tomorrow. And that's the sort of precarious situation that many of the people who are homeless or on the edge are facing. One half of those who are sheltered and turned away are children. And over one half, we believe, of those that are precariously housed are kids because parents will do all they can not to have to bring their child to a shelter or be living in a car. And so kids, we think, are underrepresented in the homeless estimates and counts. 30% of those who are homeless are in greater Minnesota. So this is a statewide problem. As Representative Moe pointed out, we have needs everywhere. I often like to tell people, if you have domestic violence, chemical dependency, mental health problems, or unaffordable housing, and households that don't have family support for when they fall into crisis, you are going to have some level of homelessness. And we need a response so that we don't let people stay there too long. I also wanted to make a comment about the Wyler Research Center survey. There was some terminology that was inaccurate. We do not do a homeless count with the Wyler survey. We do a homeless estimate and a 80-page survey that takes over a half an hour to complete with thousands of individuals on that one night. And so we don't have the numbers because we're compiling this very long survey where we want to give you a sense of what are the needs. And so I hope that we'll have some initial figures fairly soon. I can tell you that we've seen an increase in the numbers. They justify what we find in our shelters every night. And according to quarterly shelter surveys, we have 7,000 people in shelter, 1,000 turned away, and that's remained fairly consistent for the past 4 or 5 years. To sum up, I just want to talk about why this happened. And when we get ourselves into thinking that maybe we can't end homelessness, we have to think back to there was a time when many of these church-based shelters and county-run shelters didn't exist. In the late 70s, many of our cities saw that they had an eroding tax base. And we tore down a lot of skid row apartments, single-room occupancy units, and in their place put convention centers and stadiums. And almost overnight, many of the churches that right now exist and provide shelter saw 400 people. Simpson Housing tells the story about how there were 400 people almost immediately that ended up at their doorstep and they needed a place to stay. Simpson Housing and 13 other churches stepped in almost immediately to provide temporary housing for people that thought were temporarily homeless. We didn't rebuild the housing for these individuals. We built a shelter system. And in that shelter system, we started to say, well, if you're fleeing domestic violence, maybe you should go to the shelter. If you have an economic crisis, maybe you should go to the shelter. And we've really built up a system where those with the highest needs are referred to the homelessness system where they should be relying on mainstream services. The last thing that I'll point out is that if there are a few things that you can do on this committee that can end homelessness and make a really good start. One is do all you can to promote the production of affordable housing. Many people who are homeless just need housing and a little bit of support, and they can contribute some of their income to get at that. Secondly, we can prevent homelessness. Many people who are on the edge of homelessness, they'll call a shelter for help, and we have funds that come with expectations where 80 to 90% of those who are helped will not end up homeless over the next year when they receive that assistance. We can also all do all that we can to provide for the different types of supportive housing, transitional and permanent supportive housing. And lastly, I don't want to get away from this. We need to increase the amount of shelter that we do provide, that emergency short-term shelter for individuals. I got a call from my sister a little over a month ago. It was a Sunday night at 8 o'clock, and she had found a woman fleeing abuse in a Target parking lot. And she said, Michael, what am I going to do? And before I could answer the question, she said, you're going to tell me there's absolutely nothing I can do. The reason why is because we don't have staff on at many of the homeless shelters who can accommodate someone's need on a Sunday at 8 o'clock. And if there were staff on board, they wouldn't have any space. So my sister drove this family around until the morning where she could bring this person to a drop-in center. We need that entry point, that emergency shelter where people can get that immediate help they need and then get referred to something much more healthy. And you play a role in actually appropriating those dollars. I'd like to turn it now over to some of the testimony from folks who are actually providing the services and using the services, and then answer questions after that.
Okay. Let's go forward and get the testimony, and then we'll come back for questions. Welcome to the committee, and if you give us your name, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here this morning to share with you the importance of transitional housing in our community. My name is Wendy Wigman. I'm the Director of Programs at Simpson Housing Services in Minneapolis, a nonprofit agency providing emergency shelter, transitional housing, and long-term supportive housing to homeless individuals and families. Simpson Housing Services has provided transitional housing services to families for more than 20 years. Across these years, we have only seen the need rising. Just 2 years ago, we were turning away 20 to 30 families each week due to lack of space in our program. In 2006, we consistently turned away 50 to 60 families each week. The Simpson Housing Services program, and many others like ours, works with a family in emergency shelter to quickly move them into housing. Our program primarily uses a scattered site model in which we place families directly into permanent housing in the community. The lease is between the family and the landlord. We provide part of the rent based on income and intensive support services in the family's home. Our services include goal planning with assistance and assessment of progress on the plan, regular visits with a case manager, an education support advocate who works with educational stability of the kids, and regular life skills workshops. Our services are tailored to the unique needs of each family. It never ceases to amaze me the great strides that families make in the course of 2 years once they have a stable place to call home and positive, supportive relationships focused on helping to overcome obstacles. A recent example of this is a family who left our program in December. After just a little over a year, I'm going to call them Vivian and Joe. Vivian and Joe and their two kids wound up in a shelter after a series of events toppled their world. After we placed them into housing, the family established a goal plan that was mighty ambitious. Over the course of the year, Vivian finished her GED, received mental health counseling, and earned a full-time job. Joe used his time to head towards the field he'd always wanted to do, law enforcement. He took training and nabbed a good paying job that will get him closer to that goal. Their kids are getting to school every day, and we were able to see the dramatic change in them as their life became more stable. Vivian and Joe chose to leave the program early so that another family could have their spot. They left with double the income they came with, a year of good rental history in an apartment where they are setting down roots, and a new path for their family. As a provider of shelter, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing, I can testify that transitional housing is a necessary component of the continuum of housing and services in our community. Not all families need transitional housing. Not all families need permanent supportive housing. We must offer a variety of options so that homeless families can get the services that are right for them. I know what a lack of housing options can do. At some points in the past, transitional housing has been used for people who are actually in need of permanent supportive housing. Now that there are more of these options, we can be glad that transitional housing programs can be used for those who specifically need transitional housing. We celebrate that 80% of our families that we serve remain in their housing 1 year after they leave our program. And we are glad that half of the families we serve are no longer in need of housing assistance once they become stable and leave our program. These are achievements that the families could not have met had they had not had significant help during their time in transitional housing. In the continuum, transitional housing allows families the opportunity to become stable, establish goals for themselves, and determine the next steps for the future of their family. Please continue to provide the necessary support for these programs that are such an integral part of the web of services that offer families a clear way out of homelessness. With that, I'd like to ask Jessica Leffler, who is a participant in our Simpson Housing Program, to share some testimony.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Leffler. If you just give your name for the tape, please.
Thank you. My name is Jessica Leffler. My family and I live in the Harrison neighborhood of North Minneapolis. We have an apartment there. We've been there since April when we left the shelter. First, I'd like to thank you, Representative Clark, for calling this hearing because it's very important to me. And I'd also like to thank you all for this opportunity to speak on behalf of temporary housing and the need for its continued support and funding. I'm going to tell you my story. Single motherhood hit me really hard and really fast when my parents moved out with about a week's notice. I'd never really been completely on my own before. I didn't have the skills to maintain the financial stability, living on unemployment and unreliable, if not non-existent, child support. My mother had always planned and maintained my budget for me while I was working. She paid the bills. I deposited money in the account. She did that for me. Even on unemployment, she was able to make ends meet for us, and the bills got paid. But when she abruptly stopped doing my child care for me, I lost my job, and it was about that time that everything sort of snowballed. When she moved out, I was lost. I was lost financially, emotionally, and I started realizing how difficult life really was. I'd only spent 3 months living on my own up to that point. And my constant negativity and self-doubt, that those were issues that I faced pretty much my entire life, brought me even deeper into trouble. And eventually I ended up losing our apartment. When the eviction notice came, I shut down emotionally. I had no idea what to do. A dear friend came and stepped in and pretty much single-handedly moved my belongings into a storage unit. Then her and her husband discussed it, and my family of three was moved in with her family of five for a month. We spent a stressful few weeks with all five kids, four of which have special needs, and three adults in the house, and tried to blend our families together for meals and for grocery shopping. At the same time, we tried to keep them apart, to keep everyone sane. We celebrated Christmas together, their family and mine, and her husband and her had agreed that we should have the chance to have one more good Christmas before the reality of really being homeless set in. While staying at her house, I had more time to think than was probably good for me. I started out in my usual pessimistic way, taking an inventory of all the things that I had lost. A job, the only one I'd ever loved and I'd held for 3 years, longer than any other job I'd ever had. My parents, our falling out was really severe. My apartment, my purse, which was stolen from the welfare office when I wasn't looking. My car, which died while my children and I were driving and getting onto a highway. The repairs were estimated at $1,200, which was obviously way out of my unemployment budget. And finally, my dignity. I had been working stably. I had been taking care of my children with the help of my parents, and everything was lost. And at that point, my dignity was gone too. But over time, I began to do an inventory of what I had left, and I realized I had my children. Thank God for that. My mom had threatened to take them away from me. I still had my boyfriend. I had good friends. Some from an organization that I belong to and some from other areas of my life. My cell phone service was not cut off. It was paid for by a friend who wanted me to be able to keep in touch. My storage unit as well, because she thought it made more sense to keep the possessions I already had rather than try to replace them. Eventually, my car was repossessed, and I was dropped from college because of the lack of a babysitter. And therefore, I was not able to attend classes. While staying with my friend and her family, my thoughts raced like a freight train. Migraines came on pretty regularly. My emotions ran hot and cold. I didn't know what to do. I'd always been a resourceful person, but I had no resources for someone in my position. With my depression growing stronger and my self-esteem growing weaker, I didn't even know how to find the resources. Jenny found them for me and sometimes literally dragged me out of bed, forcing me to use these resources. When I went to stay at St. Anne's shelter, it felt like another blow. Now I was officially homeless, but staying in the shelter did a few things for me. It opened up new resources for me, and it gave me strength to focus on healing and helping myself and my family. I came to realize that there was only one way I could get out of the shelter and back on my feet. I had spent 5 days a week going into the Hennepin County office to see my worker on the shelter team. I'd wait around for about an hour until she was free and spend another half hour to an hour with her discussing what I'd done that week to, or that day or the previous day to get us out of the shelter.
Then I'd spend another couple of hours on the computer looking for a job in housing that would accept me, even with my half dozen unlawful detainers and two evictions. I utilized the computer at the Employment Action Center and spent even more hours looking through the classifieds and the housing link list. With all of these efforts, I finally realized that the only way I was going to get out of the shelter was if I won the lottery with Simpson Housing and got chosen to receive their rental subsidy. Faithfully, every Tuesday at noon, I called the phone number posted on the bulletin board at St. Anne's Place, the shelter that my children and I would stay in for 3.5 months. These were the longest months of my life. Every Tuesday, I would call Simpson Housing, dreading finding out that there were no openings. When there were openings in the program, I was generally hopeful, yet still a little skeptical as to whether I would ever be chosen. I had discovered that the reason why Simpson Housing had little or no openings so often was because there wasn't enough funding at those times. Those weeks were particularly depressing. The Tuesday when I finally won the lottery, I had decided to try a more positive and hopeful approach, because in the back of my mind, I held on to the knowledge that I had to get that subsidy. I knew that without a job, and with those unlawful detainers and evictions on my record, permanent housing wouldn't come along for us anytime soon. This was especially evident when I called prospective landlords and always got the same answers and responses about my rental history. Sorry, it's against our policy, or after 7 years of good rental history, I found it more and more difficult to hold out. But then one Tuesday afternoon around 4:30, my new positive approach had paid off, and I checked my voicemail and discovered that I had gotten a call back. I could hardly contain myself. I had told everyone I knew. My heart, which had been buried for 3 months, was finally soaring. Okay, I told myself, you've got the subsidy. Now find the apartment. I'd been looking. I really had, but even with the subsidy, I would have to come up with something fantastic to get an apartment. I didn't want to get in over my head. The last thing I wanted was to end up back in this position. My children deserved more than that. I deserved more than that. Finally, my tax return came, giving me enough money to pay a little bit toward my first month's rent, and I found a landlady who rents to almost everyone. That was just the break I needed. She showed me an apartment and asked me when I'd be moving in. Without a job and living only on MFIP, I knew that this would be tricky. But Simpson Housing was able to guarantee me a $500 subsidy for 4 months. That was 4 months. That was longer than I'd been in the shelter. 4 months to get settled in and find a job. I worked some temporary positions. It's hard to find a permanent job in this economy. I got my son there. I got him enrolled in a therapeutic preschool that could identify and adjust his needs. The school was recommended to me by my advocate from Simpson Housing. Through this preschool, we've also started family therapy, and I've become involved in a parenting group, which allows for a family dinner together, followed by a group for parents and special playtime for the kids. My daughter started seeing a therapist through this school. Simpson Housing also referred me to a mental health rehabilitative agency, which has a worker come to my home for visits. My advocate from Simpson also recommended an individual therapist, which I have been seeing. I became actively involved in my daughter's education. Suddenly, the hours of the day and the days of the week were consumed with taking care of our emotional and mental health needs. My family's needs were overwhelming, especially with the knowledge that Simpson Housing's initial expectations were that I would either go to school or be looking for work. But I was accepted into Simpson's 2-year program and was given a release from working or going to school. Simpson Housing became our livelihood. They support me with a family advocate. They provided us with support in so many ways, not just financial. I owe so much to Simpson Housing, and agencies like Simpson Housing provide assistance to families like mine, families who need a little more time and emotional support. There are so many of us I've found since I've become a part of Simpson. Simpson Housing and similar agencies are vital to the livelihood of so many of us, and I'm so grateful for the funding they are given to help support me and my family. Along with the money I receive from MFIP and from child support, our family is able to make ends meet. For the time being, I am grateful for the assistance I'm receiving. And once our mental and emotional needs are better met, I'll be so excited to get back to work. And eventually, I'll complete my college degree and start my own business.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wigman. We appreciate your coming today and sharing that story with us. We have one more witness, I believe, and then we'll open up to questions from the committee. We're a little tight on time, so.
I'll speak quickly. Yeah. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Leslie Frost, and I'm the Executive Director of Families Moving Forward. Families Moving Forward is a 15-year-old, faith-based social services agency in Minneapolis. We provide emergency shelter to homeless families with children. In partnership with more than 40 local congregations, representing more than 10 faith traditions. Over our 15 years of service, we have served more than 3,500 homeless persons and more than 1,000 homeless families. Over half of our homeless guests are children, and over half of our children are under the age of 6. So we are usually surrounded by toddlers, which we find is a very wonderful place to be. I'm grateful to the Coalition for the Homeless for including me in this presentation this morning. What I want to talk with you about is the state's Emergency Services Program, a grant program that operates out of the Office of Economic Opportunity in the Department of Human Services. This was one of the programs that Mr. Johnson spoke of earlier. This program was established some years ago with an annual appropriation of $350,000. In each subsequent year, the annual amount has been the same, $350,000. For the past 8 years, Families Moving Forward has been the grateful recipient of annual grants from this program of $47,500, the same amount every single one of those 8 years. I can assure you that our costs for utilities, transportation, and staff have not held steady for those 8 years. As a matter of fact, according to the Federal Reserve Bank's website, if I did it correctly, inflation has diminished the value of that grant by 21% over those 8 years. I was glad to see that the governor's proposed budget includes a 50% increase in the appropriation for this program to $525,000 per year. That increase will cover the inflation in the last 8 years, assuming OEO gives us the benefit of the increase, and a little more, but frankly, it is still not enough. Now, why is this so important? Isn't it enough that our state has a groundbreaking, and it is a groundbreaking, business plan to end long-term homelessness? Isn't it enough that thoughtful cities and counties around the state are adopting 10-year plans to end homelessness as we know it? And they are good plans. I've read them. But no, in fact, this 50% increase is not enough. High-quality, service-rich emergency shelter is the key, in fact, to bringing homeless households into affordable housing and transitional housing and supportive housing. When a family is in the first phase of the crisis of homelessness, whether it is their first time or their fifth time, they are in no shape to make good decisions about where to live next. In addition, the intake process for most affordable housing programs, supportive housing programs, whether transitional or permanent, the intake process for those programs is at least 2 weeks long, if not a month or more. This is not a criticism of those programs, it is a fact. Where will the family stay in this time, if not in a high-quality, service-rich shelter? Who will interpret the various requirements for them and help them gather the necessary paperwork, if not well-trained shelter staff, including licensed social workers? This is one very strong reason why you and the state of Minnesota as a whole should support emergency shelters with adequate annual funding, because we are the gateway to all of the other services and the housing that are available. Without us doing a good job, the system will falter, because the households will not be able to find the programs nor prepare adequately to get in them and to succeed. Therefore, each of these households will be much less liable to be successful this time and never be homeless again. But also for us as Families Moving Forward, the other reasons for the state of Minnesota to step up to this plate and provide adequate funding for emergency shelters are found in the faces of the children we serve. Children such as are pictured in the handout I brought with me today. It was passed out to you before. This is the front. And if you turn into the inner pages, you'll see the faces of some of the children that I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, I appreciate it if you'd look at some of those faces while I'm finishing. The fact is that homelessness damages children. Children who have experienced homelessness are not merely at risk for harm. They are, in fact, damaged. Let me close by quoting some facts that were gathered by the Family Housing Fund into an educational report called Children Pay the Price for Homelessness. Homelessness harms children's physical health. Children who have experienced homelessness have 2 times the rate of respiratory infections, 2 times the rate of tuberculosis, 6 times the risk of stunted growth, and 7 times the risk of anemia when compared to their peers who have never been homeless. Homelessness affects children's development. Children who have experienced homelessness have 4 times the rate of developmental delay, 2 times the rate of learning disabilities, and 3 times the rate of emotional and behavioral problems when compared to their peers who have never been homeless. Is it any wonder that up to 10% of homeless adults report that they experienced homelessness as children? With these common overwhelming deficits, each person who has experienced homelessness as a child becomes an adult with deficits as well. Deficits that commonly lead to continued poverty and lack of achievement in adulthood. We can change this. We must change this. We owe it to the children. They are, after all, our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Russ. Appreciate your coming. There's some questions from committee members, and I think we'll start with Representative Medora. Take a few minutes for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question here specifically dealing with preventative programs that we have, and I know we aren't really addressing it in the documentation here, but one thing, again, I learned from Dakota County is that they run out of TANF funding, temporary assistance to needy families, usually by mid-July. They projected that they're out of funds by September 1st. And, of course, as the weather changes and we have increased costs in heat, your car breaking down, that would have been a situation that funding would have been available for. What are you doing to advocate for that? Or will there be more representation on those increased dollars? My understanding right now is that the counties, on a goodwill measure, will take dollars out of their other funding programs to supplement the TANF need with the idea in January that those dollars are given back. But just like with any credit card, you're paying that back, you're still short funds the next year. So have we increased or have you asked for increased funding for these programs to specifically address homelessness as the objective here? Losing your car stops you from being able to go to work, stops you from being able to go to school. It just starts a spiral that oftentimes a $1,200 gift would have helped with.
Madam Chair, Representative Medora, I can't speak specifically about the use of TANF funds specifically for this purpose, but Dakota County has a Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program that they may couple TANF resources with, and there's actually a proposal in the governor's budget, and I have a bill asking for this, and I'm looking for authors, that would double the amount of money for family homeless prevention. It's a governor's proposal, and it's one that we want the legislature to support. It's a locally owned approach to homelessness in Dakota County. They often use those resources to help with the types of crises that you're talking about. They target the resources to families where they are very likely to assure some level of success, where they won't end up homeless over the next year. And because of this locally owned approach that we can only do in roughly half the counties in the state, we have success figures that exceed 80 and 90%, where the households that get the assistance and have expectations are not homeless afterwards. And it's because of a very intensive locally owned process that we are able to guarantee that. And we'd love to have more support to get more of that type of help to families. The increase would be from $7.5 million to $15
million. Ms. Amador?
Why don't you come and see me after this? Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the
call. We're meeting later today.
Thank you. And I think Representative should know that Mr. Dahl is very serious about that invitation. Any of you who are interested in being co-authors and authors of that bill, he's got the jackets with him here in the room, I bet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Let's see, the next person was Representative Kranz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was sitting here just admiring the passion you have, and I appreciate you bringing that to our committee. I mean, I know that a lot of the State Department budgets and stuff, while they're very important, don't have the same flair as somebody out there working in the field. So thank you for bringing that. But my question goes to statistics. I guess I was thinking while some of these presentations were going on, I think to me it strikes a little more of a personal chord when we find out that, for instance, rape, that we're going to know that basically one out of four women that we know has a chance of experiencing this. Maybe the numbers are greater nowadays. But I'm curious, statistically speaking, and maybe you don't have the answer to this, but maybe we can uncover this, but, you know, I've been fortunate to not have to be homeless. But I know a lot of people, I know of people close to me who are. And so I'm curious what, statistically speaking, it might be for the average population, you know, either they themselves or knowing somebody who will, for a period of time, experience homelessness. Because I think it's not something that we just necessarily broadcast out there, but I'm curious if you can give me a something to wrap my mind around.
Madam Chair, Representative Krantz, there are two statistics that I guess I'd point out. One is that in Minneapolis public schools, this year, I believe, one out of 10 children will experience some type of homelessness. Now, this doesn't mean they'll be homeless for months. It might mean that they're homeless only for a couple of days. Others will be homeless longer. But in the Minneapolis public school system has a very good system of trying to keep homeless kids in school, take them from shelters to school, and assessing needs. And so that's a pretty staggering statistic when you figure out that a school is having to deal with that level of insecurity. Nationally, I believe that on any given, someone can maybe mouth this to me, it's about 2 to 3 million individuals that experience homelessness over a 1 year period. And so it is a pretty significant number. Now, we include in homelessness someone who does not have a permanent place of their own to stay. And so when someone is fleeing abuse and doesn't have housing to go to, and they're going to a shelter, that is homelessness. And if we don't address it correctly, it can lead to something that we often identify as in the community is what homelessness is. The question is, do we have a healthy response so we can quickly get people out?
Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you aren't able to answer the question, but I would like this committee to be able to get an idea of what is that impact to the average person in experiencing homelessness. I mean, I really, maybe we can move toward that in another time, but mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lane?
I think I have two comments and a question. What you talked about before, as we were told last night, is a perfect storm of things that led to this situation. And as somebody called it, we in fact created the system that we have now, where the remove the low-income housing, build other things, and people pushed off various resources that were available, and then the increasing gap between ability to pay and how much things cost in the housing realm these days. It's just a perfect storm for inability to maintain housing. The other thing would be, for me, a key thing is the effect on children. As you were saying, that the children's physical health and developmental health, emotional health, are all so tied into stability in their early years. This is so key and relates. It isn't just a feel-good thing. It actually is the development in their brains. It is actually biological. So this condition of having these children be in these unstable situations and their parents being, the mother, for instance, being in a situation where the stress is so immense that there can't be this surround, this is a huge society piece because it leads directly to this struggle we're having with the achievement gap. It isn't a structure of just get those kids to learn better. It relates to what they have to learn with. And my question then relates, could you tell us more of why we saw more men at these shelters than women? Because women have a different way of coping, I understand?
So.
I'm sorry, I just went through a name blank. Madam Chair, Representative Lane. We saw more men, first of all, because we wanted to give you a sense of some of the more bare-bone shelters to see where some individuals were staying, and no doubt single men are very often in that system. We do have emergency shelter with mats on floors for single women as well. We didn't have the opportunity to go see those, but it was very similar, although maybe smaller in scale than the places we visited last night. But what we try to do as often as possible is when we have families who are homeless, we know that we can't have them living on the streets, and so we try to, if we don't have available shelter space, voucher them into a hotel or a motel that is very cheap and get services to them quickly. The problem is not everybody knows where they need to go to even access that possibility, and sometimes the counties don't have enough money to even cover that. And so we do a better job of hiding family homelessness because the services aren't always at a shelter, but oftentimes in either a transitional housing program or emergency shelter provided through hotels and motels. And that's actually how many of you in Greater Minnesota have your emergency shelter, is through an arrangement with a landlord who provides one of the units in an apartment or a motel to offer services to individuals.
Okay, Representative Lowell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question's for Ms. Frost, correct? Mm-hmm. You commented about the diminishing value of the grant that you received from the state of Minnesota, and in spite of the legislature's outlawing inflation and apparently still exists for you. That's obviously facetious. could you tell the committee the effect that's had on your service delivery, fewer clients, or where you've been able to make up those resources, if at all?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Moe. Ours is a standalone nonprofit. We do not receive any county funding for our shelter services. Our funding is quite diversified. In addition to the annual appropriation from the State Emergency Services Program, we receive gifts from individuals, from churches, from corporations and foundations. We sell things. We have a golf tournament. We have a holiday concert.
Whatever you can think of.
We do everything that we possibly can. And so I cannot say that the diminishment in the value of the annual grant from the state has caused us to diminish our services. It does not, because we will not let that happen. We will fight harder on every other front so that we can still provide the high quality service to our families that we believe is appropriate. I might mention also that every year our auditors let us add to our bottom line almost $200,000 in services that we receive from the congregations that support us, by providing actually the overnight shelter for the families in our shelter program. What an increase in the state grant would do is it would actually, if it could be enough, it would allow us to open up perhaps another day center site so that we could add 50% to the numbers of families that we shelter. Or it would allow us to add even more services to what we have offered the families we serve now. We serve about 60 families a year now, and if we could 50% that, obviously that would push us up quite a bit. If you'll mind, I might also say that in my view, homelessness is overwhelmingly a problem of families. If you look at the Wilder statistics, you will see that a large and increasing proportion of the homelessness in Minnesota is made up of parents and their children who are homeless together. However, if you look at another level of the statistics, you see that many of the homeless single adults who are found in the Wilder survey have minor children who are not living with them. So I count all of those as other families who are seriously affected by homelessness. And then I assume that all of the other single homeless adults, even if they don't have minor children, many of them have adult children or other family members. So I count all of the homeless people in Minnesota as families and being affected by homelessness. One more factoid I can throw your way When we look at our population through the shelter, almost 50% of our families qualify under the state's definition of long-term homeless. That means they've been out without their own independent place to live for more than a year, or homeless more than 3 times in 4 years. And the way we get that is because we count couch hopping for a family as homelessness. Because in our view, it has the same effect on the children to live in a shelter or to sleep on somebody's living room floor, not knowing any day whether you will still be there tonight. And that is what homelessness is for us when looked through the eyes of a child.
Thank you, Ms. Frost.
Thank you. Representative Swale. Excuse me, Representative Swale. Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize that I couldn't go on the field trip last night. It sounds like it was very, very meaningful. I was on another committee trip to Isanti County with the Ways and Means Committee, so that also was valuable, but I wish I had had the opportunity to do this, and maybe I can tour it privately sometime. My question has to do with the statistics from the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, relating to the statistic that says 53% of the people who are homeless are mentally ill. And the second statistic shows that 36 of the men who are homeless are veterans. And I would like to know, what is the relationship between the Department of Veteran Affairs, the many veterans hospitals, and the services that we are providing to our veterans, and being able to provide assistance to them so that they're not on the street?
Representative Swales, those statistics are of those that we survey, and so we're talking about the adult population. We don't do the surveys with children. And so the percentage of adults who are mentally ill, that includes a myriad of mental health problems from depression up to schizophrenia. You do see that the veterans, especially those living on the streets, have severe and persistent mental illness almost always. And I think if I have the statistic right, that of the adult men living on the streets, that a third are veterans, I believe, and of the total population of adults, that 20% are veterans. And what you often find is that veterans coming back have lost their community support and their networks, and find themselves on the streets. Right now, we're finding across the state veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with traumatic brain injury that you identify first as mental health problem, but it's actually a physical health problem. But we don't have the ability to assess that until someone comes in for a service. And again, if you don't know how to enter into that system, or you don't go to the VA, or going to a service scares you because of what's going on in your head, you may not get the assistance that you need. There is no doubt that the veterans programs also do not have enough to serve everybody who is in need, and that's why last year there was an appropriation to the veterans program for some transitional and permanent supportive housing to the VA home. But we do need more of that, and the governor's plan to end long-term homelessness includes some of those resources. For specifics on the Department of Veterans Affairs, I would need to defer to that department to talk about their coordination with the homeless continuum.
Thank you. Is the VA situation funded federally then, or do you look for state dollars to help support that?
And I'm sure, but I don't know enough about the state funding. There are a mixture of state and federal funds, but most of the resources, to my knowledge, are actually federal resources to VA.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, I think this will...
Just a question, having dealt for the years with constituent service, let me put it that way, and some veterans' issues. There seems to be a difference when you identify someone as a veteran and one who is service-connected who might qualify for services. And so if you could qualify what you're saying on that basis, if you have any information. I tried, at times when you have a veteran that has some needs and then you find that they're not identified with a service-connected disability, it's very difficult to get them help versus one who has the service-connected disability.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point a little bit, I think what
particularly with the troops that are coming back with traumatic brain injuries. They have had some time in the hospital to address some of those issues, which when they receive their DD-214 reflects that. So they are entitled to federal benefits in terms of those benefits. A lot of times what we find is these individuals that are out on the street don't understand how to get into the system, and that's why we have the county veteran service officers and probably working closely with those individuals to try and get them integrated. I know you, Representative Paws is very active in our area, going out to the homeless areas and saying, hey, are you a veteran, and then pulling them into the system. And that's part of what our process is, and some of the legislation we're pushing forward now is to try and create a more efficient CVSO system, try and give some incentives for them to get to the homeless people, to get them into treatment so that we are taking care of the ones that have made such a huge sacrifice. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Unless there's any other pressing questions, we've run out of our time today, and I want to thank you, Mr. Dahl, and others who have come and testified today. It's been very meaningful. Committee members, just a couple pieces of business here. One, I would appreciate a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting. Representative Schumpert, a move that we approve the minutes from the last meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes and the minutes are approved. I wanted to, there's a tour package here available for those of you who didn't get to go on the tour. We'll make sure that you get it. We'll put it right up at the front here and you can pick it up afterwards. Also, I have a request from our staff to make sure that you write your name on the governor's budget booklet that you have at your place today, so that if you want to get those back, we have your names on them and you can write your notes in there and still use them. The last thing is just to remind you that we will be having a meeting again tomorrow. We have, unfortunately, because of just longer time that we took the presentation, is very worthwhile, but we were it was necessary to bump Chip Hallbeck, the executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, to next Tuesday, and he's agreed to come then. I thank you for that indulgence. And if there's any other business to come before us, if not, then the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, committee members.